we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense? It's all about digging into the local rationality of people. Those who are working in high-risk industries, at the executive level, in all sorts of stuff. And on today's session, we've got Ben, who's going to give us a personal story about risk management in a high-risk activity. And so, Ben, over to you. Who are you, and what do you do, and how did you get to where you are now in life? And you've only got 2 minutes.
Yeah, well, it won't take that. Be done in 30 seconds, I think, with anything useful. I am Ben Goodhart. I own a small consulting company called Magpie Human Systems. We work all over the world in some really cool industries, high consequence industries. So healthcare, aviation, energy, those sorts of things. Things where if it goes wrong, you generally wish they hadn't. And I started in aviation in the early 1990s. One of those high consequence industries, through a series of unfortunate events that in that industry led to people getting laid off an awful lot. I got into the safety business, and by safety at that point, it was really accident investigation and blaming pilots, which is a really fun pastime, but was really frustrating to me, especially because I had started as a pilot. And no one likes getting blamed all the damn time. So we did.
So
all
you stop being a pilot and become an investigator, so you could do the blaming.
Well, sure, but there's still this bit of kind of feeling blamed all the time. And then if you really go home and think about it, as I sometimes did, you feel like you're doing the same thing. It's like Groundhog Day, but without the cool acting cast, and it's just same shit all the time. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
Excellent. I've already done it. And then you're making no progress. I mean, genuinely, I didn't feel like we made progress. So I had just some really incredible folks that shepherded me along the way and got me into some opportunities outside the aviation industry. And I loved it. And I still love it. So that's it. I'm here learning with you.
Excellent. And I'm really, really enjoying all the stuff you do on Punk Rock Safety. So some really cool stuff on there. And I want to hear this story. So what's the first story you've got to tell?
Yeah. So this, I was thinking about this, Gareth, because, you know, so Gareth is my spiritual advisor on LinkedIn, by the way, if you're listening to this, because I am genuinely awful at these sorts of things and Gareth is not. So I've been trying very hard to get on LinkedIn, as you know, Gareth, and do something useful. Not successful yet, but sometimes funny.
Define success. I think you're pretty successful,
Sure. And so I posted this picture of myself in a neck brace after crashing a mountain bike at pretty high speed. I mean, it was spectacular. My daughter was behind me. She's like, look, once I knew you were alive, I was like, holy crap, that was awesome.
I was going to say impressive. That's normally the word that comes out.
Yeah. I mean, really like full scorpion, right? Head first, legs over, bruised liver, the whole thing. I mean, pretty gnarly. And so I post this picture and someone who I've known for years says, this is the reason I don't do stuff like this. There's too much risk. And as safety people, we should know better. And I just thought, holy shit, how miserable.
Yeah.
And there's so many layers, right, to that, that will take far longer than this podcast. So we'll do another one someday.
So the simple bit is, so that first story is, be better, pay more attention, don't crash your bike.
Sure. Well, I was thinking about, there's a catalog of just what is often called dumb stuff by friends and family that I've done. But it's we call it adventure tax.
Yes.
The kids and I generally. So I used to do a lot of mountaineering, or a lot more than I do now. It turns out work gets in the way of a lot of stuff. But so we're doing this winter climb. Unbelievable climb. We're having a blast. There's three of us. It's going as well as winter mountaineering goes, which is sort of applied misery. But there's a purpose to it, right? Like, it's cold, it's wet, you don't have enough stuff, you're hungry. Awesome. All part of the alpine experience, and we're doing it. And we're getting ready to come down the mountain. So we've had a successful summit. We've hung out at the top. We know it's time to come down. There's weather otherwise. And we get to this place where on this route is sort of the typical descent. And we get there, and there's this sort of generally butt-shaped slide down mm-hmm. the snowfield. A glissade.
Yeah.
Or if you're French, maybe that's glissade. So someone's done it, right? And, you know, there's not bodies strewn at the bottom, so presumably they've lived. And this was not our plan. And we're walking around with crampons on. And
ice axes as well for brakes. So that works.
Yeah, yep.
Yep, all the gear.
Ice axes for all the gear. All the gear, all the helmets, the whole thing.
PPEs in place, cool.
Roped up at points, right, where it was a little more technical. All good. And we get there and we're talking, and this is a climbing partner, one of these guys that I had climbed with for ages. All sorts of technical, you know, waterfall, ice, rock, all of the stuff. So we knew our abilities really well. We were capable of climbing a lot of times out of touch, even visual or where we could hear each other. And we knew, right? So we get to this thing. We're like, whoa, what luck. Yeah,
blazed the trail already. So we know they must be safe. That's it. It's cool.
And they're not dead down there.
Yeah.
So far as we can tell. So it's been successful if living is your metric. And I said, man, that weather's coming. I mean, we could be having dinner.
Yeah.
At the time we'd still be on this mountain. What do you guys think? And none of us are sort of dumb in isolation. Well, the two of them are not dumb in isolation. And so we talk it through, and they said, well, why don't you go first? Which I took at the time as sort of an indicator of my experience, but I think now...
Sacrificial lamb.
Probably closer to that. And so I hop in and get ready. And now, when you're doing a glissade like this, you should never have crampons on. Crampons, if you're not familiar, I know you are, but for listeners, are really pointy things that are strapped to your boots, and they're meant so you don't slide down mountains.
Metal teeth that stick into the ice.
Sure. And extraordinarily well, by the way. But what we had said was, look, it's not a very long glissade. This is how this starts, right?
Yeah.
It's not a very long glissade, and I think probably as this thing kind of flattens out, we're going to be in a pretty decent position. So I think we can do this crampons on. I'm going to try it. We've talked it through. No big deal. And I made it, Gareth, a shockingly short distance before I caught a heel, crampon heel, and went just ass over tea kettle.
Yeah.
And it turns out, like most snowfields, they're slippery and steeper than you think. And this thing went for, I don't know, probably 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, maybe. So it's a long way and a good head of steam. And it ended on one side in this rock band. And then you'd go off the rock band if you were going that way. And it's about a 70-foot drop. So none of this is sort of compatible with my future success, right? And I am hauling ass down this thing. And I'm holding my ice axe, as you're meant to do, right? It's just muscle memory. I'm holding, and I'm just flipping. And I can feel the ice axe poking me as I flip. And I can feel that now, because of the sliding, my pants have also been pulled down. It's really just a bonus round. So I'm hauling ass down this thing. Finally, I get to a point where I can roll. I'm chest down into the ice. I'm laying as hard as I can onto the ice axe, and I stop
breaking here.
And I'm just beet red on my ass from sliding on ice, which is a lot closer to sandpaper than you think. I've got holes in my jacket. I've got holes in myself. I'm scraped up everywhere, and I'm alive. And yeah, and I'm a long ass way down this hill, by the way. So my buddies are up top, and I can hear them yelling, and I'm tapping the top of my helmet, which is sort of a I'm okay kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm yelling, take your crampons off, which I feel like maybe made sense to them after watching the absolute yell. So they came down, crampons off, came down, no big deal, collected me, off we went. And again, if continued life is your metric of success, here we are. But that's it. That's, you know, yet another exciting story of me maybe doing things that books are written about. I think there's an accidents in North American mountaineering that is very close to a description of my life.
Interesting.
So there it is.
No, and it's a really interesting bit. And so the discussion that's been in the last few days, you're talking about, you'd mentioned Alex Honnold and the bit about how do you manage risk. And I think it's a really interesting discussion. You know, I dive, I've mountain biked, I've rock climbed, I've sort of free soloed down a face and fell about 30 feet and tore the ligaments in my left ankle and cracked a rib about 2 inches right in my spine. And, you know, you just look at these things and go, that was a bit dumb. But one of the things that really gets me is that risk is given a negative connotation. We only see risk in the negative. And there's always a reward in the positive side of risk as well. So what is it we're doing? Yeah. So in the adventure sports space, and I've just interviewed Ken Wiley for a podcast that'll come out a couple of weeks before this one. And,
Ken.
It's just talking about we have to get out there and we have to trade off the fun, the experience against the time, against the money. If you're in the professional guiding business like Ken is, and how do you trade off these things? And then when people just go and do it for fun, it sits outside of the traditional risk management process because the rewards are all skewed in a very different way. There's no financial benefit, or mainly there's no financial benefit. So what is it that's the reward and how do we manage that? So mountain biking, mountaineering, glissading. So to talk about that, how do you manage, how do you bridge that between sort of adventure sports and the safety business?
And so this is sort of right to the point of you and I having a conversation before. This is sort of the second story behind it, right? The sort of how, and I gave a little bit of that away in the beginning of us sort of trying to rationalize this. It's a weird thing to me to hear those comments about, aren't you supposed to be a safety guy? And that's a really typical
comment.
And having done, like you, a lot of these sorts of things, rock, ice, mixed mountaineering, all the sort of climbing. I was a whitewater kayaker for years. My shoulder doesn't cooperate so much anymore. You know, and there's times actually, you know, whitewater kayaking is another one of those times where I've nearly killed myself, right? And no financial benefit to it. And, you know, I've sort of prodded at a guy named Preston Klein a couple of times. And Preston, I met years ago at a Wilderness Risk Management Institute conference. I don't know if Preston remembers that. He's probably blocked it from his memory. But at the time, what he was presenting on was the etymology of risk. And without getting too esoteric about it, what is so stinking cool to me is that 400 some odd years ago, the word risk, or its root word, was predominantly positive.
Mm-hmm.
It was predominantly a description of adventure.
Wow, okay.
And the reason that I think that's so important is that personal growth, self-discovery, you know, the sort of emotional connections are forged in our brain when we, or accelerated at least, when we are under this sensation of risk.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I don't think that's, people talk about adrenaline junkies. For me, it's not that. I get scared shitless doing some of this stuff. So, and I know that, right? And I'm not seeking being terrified. What for me makes sense doing it is sort of this discovery of truth.
Mm.
Like, you can't lie to yourself very long in the outdoors doing that kind of stuff. It'll get you. And I think for me, and again, it's roundabout. So now here, I think I'm actually answering the question about how does this reconcile with safety and risk, is we tell people all the time, be more curious, be humble, right?
Yeah.
You know, think about this sort of negotiation of risk. If you're not curious and you're not humble and you're pursuing these sorts of things, you will be taught curiosity and humility extraordinarily quickly. And I think for me, it is such a beautiful way of doing that. And you can do that. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do that. Fishing is a good way to do that. Right? Being outsmarted by an animal with this tiny little brain all the time is a really good humility building exercise. So I think this, the sort of skill of safety, and I think about it as risk interpretation, navigation, right? I've heard it called risk translation. I don't think it's that. I think it's this sort of making sense of risk as an interpreter. I think you can't be a very good interpreter if you're not out in it.
I totally agree with that. And one of the things,
I don't want to melt down a reactor, right? But I can go have a little bit of control doing this.
And I think control's really an interesting piece, because I often talk about wingsuit flyers in my community. When I'm teaching my classes, my diving classes, and you'd sit there and go, would you want to go wingsuit flying? It's like, no, it's dangerous. Yeah, but you go several kilometers back in a flooded cave system in Mexico and you go cave diving. Isn't that dangerous? And people think it's about adrenaline, and it's about the my perception is it's about the control, not about the adrenaline. And actually, what can I control in my bounds? And I think that's that bit of what's outside of my control, and that brings the sort of the fear and the sharpening of attention that goes with it.
Yeah. And sort of almost the purposeful surrender to lack of control.
Mm.
And I think just... Here's the thing for me, right? I tend to get, and maybe less so now, but certainly when I was younger, like really anxious in just daily life about, you know, financial stuff, right? Control, right? Or work. Oh, should I make this decision or this decision?
Girls.
And the point I think I was trying to make when I put Alex Honnold on there is it really isn't that scary.
Yeah.
Right. It shouldn't be. No, it is what it is, right? It was scary to me. But I think for me, it was a really good way of exercising that and saying, all right, if I'm going to feel out of control, let's pick the out of control. Not so much what I can control, but you know, I'd rather my bank account not be the thing teaching me the lesson. I'd rather be outside doing something really cool. And that can teach me a lesson too. And that doesn't mean, I mean, there is no abandonment of sort of risk navigation or
mm-hmm.
you know, almost the most fun of it is understanding.
Yeah.
And learning in that real time. And I do think it is, I think Sid Decker, at least at one point, talked about that being a negotiation, right? It is. We say trade-offs a lot, which sounds nicer.
Yeah.
But it is a genuine negotiation. Go, okay, well, if I can do this, can I do that? And
so how do you think, I'm just thinking now of modern sports, of where mountain bikes are now, where mountaineering gear is, where scuba diving gear is. Where do you think technology is shifting that? And technology, I mean, in the general piece in terms of the equipment. You look at what your bike looks like now with a suspension, unreal. The disc brakes versus go back 30 years as a thing that probably weighed about 30 pounds.
Gareth, I was riding a hardtail mountain bike until 3 months ago. It was a beautiful hardtail, right? But I think they might be onto something with this whole suspension thing. It might catch on.
Is that the one you broke when you fell off and you broke your neck?
Well, I didn't break my neck, to be honest. Look, if we're going to be clear. And I didn't break... I mean, the bike was injured, but not broken. Totally fixable.
Okay.
All good. I think you can get away with more to a point.
Yeah.
All the gear in the world would not have changed what happened when I went glissading with crampons on. It, that was independent of outcome. That was a bad choice. It could have ended fine. Yeah. It was still probably not a great idea. I could have the world's most expensive crampons, the best ice axe, right? But that's not going to save me. But the mountain bike, I think, gives me, I always think about.
Even the mountaineer. So in that situation is, yes, it's not going to help you in that particular situation because, you know, it's using the right gear in the wrong place. But actually just looking at ice screws and axes and the technology that allows you to expose, get to places that you previously couldn't have done. Yeah. So there's this bit that actually gets
kind
you...
of, and diving though too.
Has absolutely, it is. Yeah, the technology allows you to get you to places, and I think that's an interesting one. Is the gear is now the diving gear is so reliable that now it is definitely coming down to the human physiology, human health, and the decision making processes that are there. Whereas before it
do
was.
Do you think that that's? Do you think that that's like, I'm sorry to interrupt.
No.
But like Air France 447 is a pretty famous example, right, of a heavily automated aircraft that all of a sudden relied on pilot, perfect pilot skill. And it ended quite badly, and it's easy, of course, to blame pilots. But I think maybe is that sort of a parallel?
The automation, because now there's this belief that it just does it. And it's one of the things that I try to bring into the classes, especially now moving into some of the military rebreathers who are getting more electronics in there and actually trying to explain to them that their normal operation training burden is likely to go down, but their contingent training burden goes up because they're never going to really encounter it. And so they have to, in the same as, you know, startle training for pilots is or upset condition training. You sit there going, "What's it doing?" Okay, and
which happens.
Yeah. So I think you know from your helmet, you know that's probably saved your life on your bike crash.
Yeah.
Where that's 100%. Come these days as little rubber tubes, or now it's a full on face
leather, a little bit of leather. Yeah, unreal. Unreal. Yeah, I think...
So do you think that exposes or encourages people to get exposed to a higher level of consequence?
Ooh. I think it makes it less obvious when you're... Because I don't think that it's just sort of an even slope, right? It's almost logarithmic, right?
Yeah.
So... Some risk, a little more, and then holy crap, right here we are. And I think it's easier to get closer to the holy crap part without noticing.
Yeah.
Because of, and again, the diving stuff, I don't dive because drowning is terrifying to me. And it sure looks a lot like that. So it's not really my thing. It's like the divers who don't want a wingsuit.
Yeah.
Or me when I used to fly jump airplanes for a little while, right? Have never skydived in my life. Sounds like a horrible idea, but I was happy to chuck those knuckleheads at the 22 of them at the back of the airplane. And that's parachutes are that way too, right? The whole wingsuit thing. I don't know when those came about, but you know, 40 years ago, it was not happening like it is today. So I think it's closer to get to. Is it? I think
there's less margin for recovery.
Well, I think it's you'll know what I'm talking about, but it's the sort of financial workload.
Yeah.
You know what I'm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think it's
and I'll put a link in the show notes to explain that image is, so we didn't have to wave your hands in the
I'm drawing with my hands. But that part, you know, where we have sort of the boundary for safety, and you can step over it and not something bad, you know, you go 10 miles an hour, 10 kilometers an hour over the speed limit, the camera doesn't always get you, right?
Yeah.
Or the police officer doesn't always get you. So there is that boundary. I think that boundary shrinks almost. It maybe pushes out further, and then the flex space shrinks with really good gear.
Yeah.
I don't know. You've got me on this one a little bit, but I'm thinking in real time, which is dangerous.
But I think there's also, and I think it's an important piece, because if we go into the sort of the safety space and the industries that are there, that we've created really safe systems that people are there and they don't understand the energy that's there or whatever.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And you just, I'm going to say, get lulled into a false sense of security. Of a recent set of meetings I was talking about where they were operating an aircraft that doesn't have an APU. So they run one of the engines, the turbine then basically provides power until they're running ground power, and they put the prop brake on. But people don't recognize the issue that this is a live engine. And the prop brake could fail at any one time. But because those sorts of things are not talked about, and we believe that, hey, it's an aircraft, it's signed off at really high levels of safety integrity, right. It must
and it
be
doesn't
safe.
Fail very often.
No. But when it does, and if somebody's in there, endex. So but fortunately that doesn't, you know, people go, oh, and get knocked out the way, or, you know, they're fractions of a second away from the disc. And it doesn't have that sort of pit. So, yeah, I think it's a really interesting discussion piece that the probability of kill should be one, not a fraction. And it's that recognition piece that says if it's a fraction, we have no idea where we are. But if we just assume that the probability of kill is one, then actually it's there.
It is shocking how often I'm going to go see some folks in an airport next week. But I always talk to people at airports about this, because this is, it's shocking to me. People should be just absolutely dying left and right at airports, it feels to me.
Yeah.
I'm not advocating for
that.
No,
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, right. But as a matter of just common sense, right? You let anyone from the public into this place. And if you've seen the general public, right, we're part of it, but
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure it's a great idea next to metal tubes with engines on them. And we put them all together, and we put them on this shiny metal tube, and we fly it, launch it from one place to another. And it just happens all day, all the time. And the world doesn't explode. And that is just bananas to me. And I think that same point you've made about the technology is so stinking good.
Yeah.
That we forget almost how quickly that probability of one ought to be. I mean, it's pure magic that it isn't.
Oh, absolutely. But, and even just talking at like a system level and understanding all of the moving parts. So what last...
This is going to be a 7-hour podcast.
No, it's not. We've still got about...
System level. Okay.
So so last Monday, flying back from Lisbon back to Bristol, having done a sort of conference presentation down there, and sort of wake up in the morning and your flight's delayed an hour and a half. You're like, oh, okay, fine. And then as I'm getting closer to the time that I should go to the airport, it gets close to back to, yep, your aircraft's back on time now. It's like, oh, that's cool. How did they manage to recover an hour and a half? That's impressive. Anyway, so we get to the airport and the times on the gates are as scheduled. And then all of a sudden we're about, you know, 10 minutes to go. It then jumps 2-hour delay. You're like, what? So I go and look on flight tracker or whatever and see which airframes are flying in, and then realize that my aircraft's still at another airport and it hasn't taken off yet. And you're like, oh, right. And so, you know, we get out onto the aircraft, 3 hours late, we're departing. And you realize that there are the knock-on effect that, you know, you've got this jigsaw puzzle with the pieces in it and the holes keep moving. And it's like, right, I'm going to stick my piece in there. Oh, nope, that didn't work. Right. And So aircraft are in places, crews are in places, passengers are in places, bags are in places, and there are slots in the airspace and at the airfield that allow aircraft to move in and out. And you think, how does this work? Magic. Little fairy dust somewhere.
Yeah. PFM, as they say.
Effing magic. There you go.
Fantastic magic, it must be. I don't know. I'm sure there's other words.
Absolutely. So it's...
I don't know if I've answered anything about sort of the you know, how did it happen or second story, but I think we've talked about some really cool things that go into why in the hell would you be on the side of a mountain anyway?
Yeah. And I think actually that reward piece is a really important piece. Again, we go back into the business space where people go, oh, why did you do that? You could see it was going to go and end up going wrong. It's like, yeah, but I've got all of these other positive aspects about why we do stuff, about money, about time, about, you know, not losing something is a reward. So, you know, it's understanding those behaviors.
And here's the point, I think, that... So I think when people hear reward, they think of some dimly lit, smoke-filled room with executives sitting in it going, moo-hoo-ha-ha. Right, Dr. Evil, and people, again, that sort of thrill seeking, right? And I don't think, I mean, that's not reward in the most typical sense. I think, again, looking back at that original definition of risk, which is, you know, adventure, it is the probability of growth, of knowledge seeking. I mean, these are things that in every aspect of life, other than that, in hindsight, right, we say are admirable, that we hire people for.
Yes.
You know, these self-starters, these innovators. And then when it goes to shit, it's a fun trick to say, well, you were just chasing, right, this sort of selfish reward. And you go, no, hold up a second. And I think that to me is so, so hard for folks to separate. Especially as you get further from a business setting, we tend to blame everything on financial reward. And I have a lot of time for leaders because I've just met so many that don't seem like Dr. Evil. But also, you know, divers don't just seem like selfish assholes.
No,
right?
So
I've met a lot of them.
And they go, you know, they're on vacation. In the States, you only get two weeks holiday a year, you know.
Well, so, now, wait a minute. Let's all right, get then. Crazy. Maybe 2 weeks.
Well, yeah, so you've got limited time away. And right. So you sit there and go, right, I'm going to fly across the world. I'm going to spend $7,000 or $8,000 on a holiday. It's a bit marginal weather. Yeah, I've got a bit dodgy stomach. It'll be okay. Because the reward is not losing. And I think that's the bit then is, I don't want to lose out on this. And, you know, with the whole sort of GoPro culture and the fear of missing out. Hey, did you see the big sharks that were down there? You know, intentionally, as opposed to they're going to go and hunt you. You know, it's just for those who are scared about it. You know, it doesn't happen very often. But there's a fear that's there. So there was something else I was going to pick up, but I can't remember what it was. So the final piece then is, what would you recommend as a book or as a paper or as a video or something for people to go and dig into that you think might help people understand what we've been talking about, the second stories about risk? I mean, if you don't say it, I'm going to say Risk Savvy, go and read that. But so you can't use that one.
No. I so you get two votes out of two for Risk Savvy, I think is a really cool read. Gareth, it has nothing to do with sort of traditional...
Good.
You know, hop people want to read hop books and things like this. And I love a good mountaineering book. So there's a book called Minus 148.
Ooh, I've not heard this one.
It's the first winter ascent of Denali.
Wow.
Highest mountain in Alaska, 20,320 feet. It's a pretty tall mountain. And a relatively unforgiving mountain on a good day, but in the middle of winter, winters is miserable. So the wind chill I think
this is Fahrenheit we're talking about, not centigrade.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, Kelvin. It's Kelvin. Kelvin. So it's really cold. So minus 148 degrees Fahrenheit was as low, I think, as the wind chill calculations
scales
went
go down to
on the chart. And it was colder than that. And these guys were living in a snow cave and miserable, losing fingers, losing toes. And
you go,
what in the world? Why would you do that? And this book is it's just a wonderful story about what they were thinking and how they were thinking and how this made sense. And I just think to hear from the people that were in it, like the questions that you're asking, Gareth, yeah. I think are built into that book. And then Reinhold Messner, who is just one of the premier mountaineers of all time, has written probably four or five books. And it's a trip to read. He writes completely differently.
Yeah.
And you can sort of, if you watch some videos of Reinhold Messner, you can sort of read that in his voice, which makes it more fun. But that guy's been on some epic adventures. And it's really stinking cool, I think, to read or listen to and learn from these folks that are just expert navigators of risk.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a little out of
no, no, it's cool. Realm. And I think that's a really important piece is to explore those different perspectives, because you sit there and go, definitely first story territory. What on earth are you doing? And then you dig into it and go, right, that's it. You're not being incompetent or naive. You're properly aware of what's going on. And you're trying to control those risks as best you can and fail safely as best you can.
Exactly, right? And I think that's part of the fun of it, right?
Yeah.
It's that sort of how well can I prepare to navigate this sort of stuff? And I'm never going to be the subject of a book. Well, not that.
Oh, I'm sure you could be.
Starting to be a good compendium so far. Not that kind of, look, I'm amateur at best. But it is really, really cool to see what just some of the most interesting folks in the world are doing. And it is unbelievable. You ever watch David Letterman? Did you see the old Letterman
show?
Well, then it'll be lost on you. But so for the American listeners, they'll know. But they used to do Stupid Human Tricks,
mm-hmm.
right? Was sort of a segment on the show. And I always just tell people, man, that's funny, but I think awesome human tricks are so cool to read about and learn from.
Yeah.
And it's not always success so much as it's just people doing unbelievably cool stuff. So that's some of it. Minus 148.
Cool. Very cool. Thank you. And the bit about, high altitude mountaineering, just remembering of guys walking on knife ridge edges. So that piece about, failing safely is if they go that side, I have to jump the other way. So you're in this bit of the only way I can save my mate is now put myself into a similar situation because we now act as a pendulum at either side of the ridge. And he's like, yeah.
So what? You really have to like your friend.
Yeah. The thing is, if you don't, you're going over the same side as he is.
Well, sure. Yeah, I don't
know. So it's really cool. It's great to chat to
you. Yeah, Gareth,
I
want
to
go climbing?
so I have...
Let's tie ourselves together and see what happens.
Yeah, so last February, I was up in Calgary teaching a class. And one of the students there is a nice climbing instructor up there. She's like, Sabrina's going, come on, let's come out. So, and I love Calgary. So it's, maybe next year. I need to lose a few pounds. But then
I'll go first. I think we've established it's kind of a norm.
It was more about me hauling my weight up as opposed to you.
Yeah, no, look, I'm telling you, it's a comparison. Once you're compared to me, you'll feel fantastic.
Excellent. Ben, thank you very much. And looking forward to seeing you in real face-to-face time at some point. So thank you. And keep the punk rock safety going.
Thank you, my friend.
Take care.